Hi, I'm Ben McAdams, and you're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I represent the political center, and I'm proud to be joined by Shireen Gourbani on the left and John Dougal on the right.
Hey, good to be with you.
We're so happy to have you here.
It's good to be back. Thanks for having me back. I'm a little rusty, so thanks for giving me the chance to try out my vocal cords again and be back on Both Sides of the Aisle.
Well, how are you doing? What are you up to? Can you give listeners a little?
I'm doing really great. I'm still a senior fellow at Sorenson Impact at the University of Utah. I'm doing a little bit of consulting.
Does that mean an old guy? What a senior fellow mean?
Right? It means wise, not
oh,
old.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
Okay.
Although you might notice I'm wearing readers. I got to that age that I can't read without having glasses. Kind of embarrassing. But
oh, you look great.
I am a senior fellow.
There you
so,
go.
Yeah.
It's very distinguished.
But just loving actually raising my kids. We have four kids. They play baseball and soccer and mountain biking. So I'm just enjoying a little bit of free time.
Grandkids yet.
No grandkids. Our oldest, our twins are 16, almost 17. And then we have a 14-year-old and an 11-year-old. So enjoying just some family time.
But, yeah, that sounds nice.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
Yeah.
Well, let's jump right in. Speaking of family, the Queen Mother passed away this week. It's been interesting to see her celebrated and a little bit of criticism about the colonialism and during her reign and that. But I would say just a profound loss for the globe and the leadership and presence that she had. What do you think?
Yeah, well, so I have to say I'm not a person who's typically interested in the royals, okay?
Yeah.
So it's not something that I...
You didn't stream it on Netflix?
No, I didn't. I didn't watch the show. I don't particularly care for the institution. And I'm a little bit reminded, I would say, that I remember so distinctly when Diana died. And I would say that was the last kind of moment of real interest that I had. But I don't follow it closely. But I do, you know, I've been listening to a number of podcasts and different news interviews. And I will say one of the things that's standing out and I do think is quite interesting is the kindness that she really showed to Barack Obama when he was often in some really difficult conversations, ridiculed by other leaders across the globe. She was incredibly kind and warm, and he shared some of those memories this week. And I think that's something that kind of piqued my interest. I thought that was curious. But certainly as a person who's got a lot of, you know, negative feelings about sort of the broader colonial efforts that we have seen, of course, by our own country and others. And it's a complicated history, but certainly you cannot deny that this is a person who was in public life for, I mean, what feels like a century.
Well, for most folks, it was forever.
Forever.
Yeah.
And it's mind-blowing, and it's such a giant shift. And I do wonder what the future of kind of the royals and the standing will be without her leadership. John, what about you?
Yeah, I'll also admit I don't fully understand monarchy and the interest and stuff like that and how it's carried on. But clearly she represented the country well in so many ways. And I heard this little anecdote, you know, just the other day, and it was talking about how she likes to go out to her vacation home in Scotland as she's cruising around and driving herself and so forth. And she stopped and we were visiting with these Americans who didn't know who she was. And they asked where she lived, and she goes, well, my home's in London, but I have a vacation home out here in Scotland and just over the hill there. And they're like, oh, great. How long have you been out here? Oh, about 80 years. Oh, you must know the Queen. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know her. You know, she's kind of a spunky person and stuff like that. And after they left, the Queen said to the person that was with her, I wonder if anybody's going to point out who he was with.
Amazing.
I have to admit, I don't understand the monarchy that very well either, but it'll be interesting to see how it transitions now to King Charles. I read a story about an individual who was arrested for speaking out against King Charles, right?
Yeah.
I thought very Game of Thrones-y that, you know, that's what I understand about monarchy is you go to jail if you criticize the king, but it'll certainly be a transition.
I didn't watch Game of Thrones either.
Well, there was kind of a negotiated understanding with the Queen Elizabeth, right, that she was the monarch and she had a role and she didn't exceed, you know, she let the democracy and the elected officials have their role. And it'll be interesting to see if that continues and how that continues with Charles now.
Yeah, especially. OK, so back to the Diana situation, too. I do wonder what the public perception is of Charles. And I do wonder, as king, my understanding is he's been deeply committed to and is very concerned about climate change and climate chaos that we're living with. So I am interested in what will his role be. And, I can't say that the Queen, it would be hard for me to say what was really like the big driving kind of thing in the political moment for her. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out.
But we get this change at the same time we have a new prime minister.
Yeah.
I mean, literally days in the job.
Big changes. We'll have to see how it plays out. So I want to talk a little bit about Ukraine. Speaking of big changes, right, we saw in the last couple of days, Ukraine has had a counteroffensive that seems to be successful. They've regained thousands of square kilometers of land. Where does this go?
Well, I mean, I think what it does is show just how, I think everyone overestimated the Russian military and underestimated what Ukraine would be able to do. The doggedness and tenacity that they have shown, and really the strategy, I think is, it's remarkable. It's also just disturbing to me how, the whole thing is disturbing, but in particular, the perceptions that we had about the Russian military might and what has happened over this time is so out of step with the expectations that were set.
One of the things, clearly President Zelensky is going to use this as a message. You know, I talked about the tools that we need to fight this war. He started getting those tools, and look at the advances we're starting to make. We're able to launch rockets back behind their lines to cause havoc. And so he's going to say, see, I told you so. I mean, keep supporting us. And so you've got those dynamics at play, and I think success feeds on success. And
certainly seeing the messaging of that, the impact. I think the impact that, that the Russian military is not invulnerable, that they are losing to Ukraine these days, and the message of sustained support for the Ukrainian military. It's inspiring to see how much they fought back, and the implications of this will be felt for decades, right?
Yeah. I just wonder, so how does this end? You know, it seems like, I feel like from the beginning, we were saying this would come to some sort of diplomatic agreement. But I don't know. They might just run them straight out.
Well, the other dynamic you have is you have Russia, who's reaching out to Iran for drones and other technology, and reaching out to North Korea for military supplies. Kind of an interesting dynamic.
An interesting axis, right? So, and, you know, interesting to see. I've also seen some press about elected officials in Russia speaking up, calling for the removal or impeachment of Vladimir Putin. That's got to take some courage.
Incredible courage.
But you're seeing it. It's becoming, I don't want to say it's common, but you're seeing it. Maybe the pace of that pick up a little bit. So certainly I would have to say at this point, it looks like he's been damaged. Not only the reputation of Russia, but the reputation of Vladimir Putin's been damaged.
Yeah.
Deservedly so.
Yeah.
So moving domestically, right? Yes. Let's talk about this Senate race that seems to be heating up here in Utah. I think in full disclosure, I think everybody knows this, but I'm a big supporter and friend of Evan McMullen. I've been a friend of the campaign and a supporter of that campaign. But as typically happens, Labor Day comes, people go back to school, and all of a sudden, the general public wakes up and cares about an election, and you start seeing the gloves come off and it really heating up. So McMullen had a rally this week in which he called out Senator Lee, called him a sycophant for Trump, criticized him for his role in questioning the integrity of the election and the lead up to the January 6th insurrection. And then both campaigns released different polling. McMullen campaign released a poll showing him ahead of Mike Lee by 1 percentage point. And the Lee campaign released a poll showing Mike Lee ahead by 18 percentage points. So very different. What do we think about this?
Very different polls. Well, so I think that there are a couple of things to consider, right? Polls are often released by campaigns to craft a narrative one way or the other. So that's certainly part of it. But you can kind of understand the veracity of polling by really looking into the numbers and trying to get a little bit more information. I haven't seen that Mike Lee poll, but I would be very curious about who conducted that poll and would want to get
when they conducted that.
But I have to say, I think there's so much happening kind of in the broader Utah discourse around things that, I think are concerning to people when we think about Republican leadership and some of the more traditional ways that we're seeing Mike Lee. We're talking about, the potential. In fact, Lindsey Graham came out today with a proposal for a nationwide abortion ban at 15 weeks, which is draconian among many other concerning things, these, efforts that we're seeing to overturn the election. We're also hearing Republicans talk about massive cuts to Social Security, to Medicare. These are things that I think are concerning to people. And so when you're putting that in the context of Mike Lee running 18 points, I find it hard to believe, given the challenges that people have and some of the things we're hearing from Republican leadership.
John, you're outnumbered by Democrats, which is rare,
there
I know.
You go.
But I want to hear your voice.
This is an outlier condition right here.
Yeah.
But, one of the dynamics is clearly I think Mike Lee's been smart in his campaign. He's running against Joe Biden and Joe Biden's agenda. And I think that is a message that resonates with many Utahns, the overwhelming majority from my perspective. I don't think they're thrilled with, the price of gas. Yeah, it's down, but it's still significantly higher than it used to be. The price of food, concerns about what's going on with the economy, other things like that. They just don't like Joe Biden's agenda for America. And so for Mike Lee to position himself to say he's fighting against that, he's there with the everyday Utahns fighting against it, I think is a powerful message. He's not really focused on his opponents. He's focused on Joe Biden.
But I think it's a hard argument, though, right? Because what we're hearing from Republican leadership in the Senate is about significant cuts to Medicare, to Social Security. These are not popular ideas that somebody should run on. So it makes total sense to me that Mike Lee would want to make this about Joe Biden, as opposed to any real ideas that he's bringing to the table. But we know that
To your point, though, you know, those programs are going bankrupt. I mean, those programs are spending more than they're taking in as it is. So just on the trajectory they're on, they're not sustainable. And folks finally at least need to be talking about the fiscal matters, not just on those issues, but debt and everything else and spending. And both parties have had problems with this historically.
So if you're a person who is moving towards retirement and your entire life you've paid into that system, you're looking at a candidate who's really seriously interested in cutting Medicare and cutting Social Security. And I think that should be on everybody's minds when they're going to vote this fall.
I want to bring it back to the polling. So the Salt Lake
Tribune,
right? The polling. The polls.
One out of three hosts cares about polling.
You know, Brian Schott at the Salt Lake Tribune had an excellent article going through the two different polls and saying, look, you should have a healthy dose of skepticism when you're looking at a poll. Because, look, campaigns aren't going to release their internal polling unless it serves their purpose. And so I looked at these. And as I said, I'm a friend of the McMullen campaign. I have some conversations behind the scenes about
sure.
that poll. And I know as a candidate myself, like, yes, you always want to release a good – look, if the poll showed McMullen losing by 20 points, they wouldn't put it out.
Sure.
But this poll showed it close. I've been in similar conversations with my pollster wanting to put it out. Pollsters have reputations. They care about their reputation. They're not going to come up with a bogus poll. So I know for a fact that that poll is legitimate, that shows that race very closely, that it's very close, right? I wondered to myself why – you know, even if you're way ahead, I think any candidate wants to show the race close to motivate your own supporters. So
right.
I wondered why Mike Lee would release a poll showing with an 18 percentage point lead. What purpose did that serve to release a poll like that?
Yeah.
And I think what it was, you know, I saw earlier this week Mike Lee release support from a lot of Republican elected officials, many of whom I know don't like Mike Lee. But the light bulb went off to me that that's why you release a poll showing you're 18 percentage points ahead. It's to tell people who might be looking at fleeing the campaign and abandoning the campaign to say, you better not do that. You better stay with me. It's inevitable that I'm going to win this race. But I know we've got a close race on our hands. It's going to be interesting to see how it takes shape over the next couple of months.
Yeah.
Well, and you've got the dynamic with polling, which depending on who's doing the poll, some people will be more honest or less honest depending what the expectation is. They're going to try too often to answer what they think the pollster wants to hear rather than necessarily what they might be thinking on one side or the other.
Yeah,
for sure. Polling is much of an art as it is a science, right? You can approach it with a science, but there's an art to it. And at the end of the day, like, I don't know, we've all seen polls be wrong, right? So, but, you know, I'm encouraged. I think we got a close race. The nation is now focusing on this. The 538 ranked this the eighth most competitive race in the country right now.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot more to see before this race is over.
That's right.
A lot more commercials to hear on the radio and TV.
Yeah, you might buy DVR or turn off your TV for the next couple of months if you don't want to see the endless stream of commercials. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Ben McAdams with Shireen Gourbani and John Dougal. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider donating to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Shireen Gourbani on the left.
John Dougal on the right.
And I'm Ben McAdams in the political middle. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. So for the second segment, I thought we'd start off with a new segment like Stephen Colbert does, right? The new segment called Good Regulation, Bad Regulation. We were talking before the show started about some ideas with that, and I want to throw it over to John Dougal, who always has thoughts about
regulation.
All regulation is bad regulation. That's for John Dougal.
That's right. Well, government regulation is the bad part. You know, people regulating their own business.
Sure.
Hey, great, I'm good with that. But I look over there once again at California. California has, what is it? Their fast food council. And what they're trying to do is have this council that's going to set wages and benefits and other compensation practices and so forth for fast food employers in the state, but not all fast food employers, large ones, okay? Large ones, except for those that sell bread as a standalone item. So it's different funky carve-outs. And it's like, seriously, the restaurant owners are the ones that care the most about hiring and retaining workers and servicing their customers. And so to have some government board that thinks they know best how they're going to manage and micromanage this part of the economy, I think is horrible. And what it's going to do is drive certain of those businesses out of business, Others are going to restructure to try and avoid the regulations. And I just don't see this ending well. But once again, this is California in their infinite, from my perspective, stupidity, saying we're going to regulate something we don't know much about.
Hmm.
Shireen?
So, well, what's on my
mind? Did I tee it all right for you?
What's on my mind in response to that is you sure follow the news in California, which is interesting to me. But also, I just caught a report, and maybe we can drop it in the show notes, that listed Utah in one of the top worst states for workers. And so when I think about that, I think about the fact that we haven't been able to do an increase of the minimum wage here. We're still talking $7.25. And in fact, the legislature, in its infinite commitment to local control, does not allow local municipalities, if they would like to raise that minimum wage, to be able to do that. When we think about the fact that we're really at the bottom of the barrel for women in this country, access to childcare, working conditions, there are so many things. The fact that this is a right to work state, so it's very difficult for unionized labor to really provide worker protections. I understand that what you're talking about does feel a bit extreme to me when we're thinking about a fast food council. But when I'm thinking about a state that is at the really bottom of the barrel when it comes to workers' rights and protections, I'm not really ready to throw stones at another state, especially one where people generally have better working conditions than they do here.
I'm gonna weigh in with former representative, current state auditor John Dougal on this one. Like, look, I'm somebody who believes in the free hand of the market. I also, maybe this is why I'm a centrist.
And sometimes the backhand of the market.
Yeah, the backhand of the market. But maybe this is my place as a centrist Democrat, but I do believe in the free hand of the market and that markets are powerful tools. It's because of markets that we have cures for diseases. We have smartphones. We have raised humanity out of, like, poverty. Poverty still exists, but so many people lifted out of poverty into enjoying the comforts that we enjoy today. So I'm a big believer in the power of markets properly regulated.
Yes.
So I think markets need to have guardrails, and markets respond to the incentives we place upon them. But when we try to come in and plan the economy, plan the market with government, even in spite of its best intentions to really regulate outcomes, I don't think government can replace the power of a market. Now, it's one thing to put guardrails on it, but another to come in, as California is doing. Now, I didn't hear about this till we were talking about it, but California to come in and plan every level of it. I'd much rather see incentives and guardrails than I would kind of this top-down, heavy-handed approach.
Well, you talked about sometimes government, you know, their reaction causes other problems down the road. You want to talk about some of the dynamics when it comes to landscaping and so forth?
Yeah, so good policy, bad policy, good regulation, bad regulation. I was also pleased to see some leadership coming out of Salt Lake City, Mayor Mendenhall and the council looking at, as our other municipalities across the state, looking at park strips, right? We are in the middle of a drought, and they estimate that Americans—
Park strip. This is the little grassy strip in between the sidewalk and the road.
Each household uses 5,000 to 8,000 gallons of water per year on that little park strip. And yet government regulation mandates that we have grass or vegetation in that park strip. It's probably time to pull back that regulation a little bit. People want to use less water. Let's not have government, this is, again, the problem with well-intended regulation. We're requiring people to do something that we don't want them to do. So I was proud to see Salt Lake City, Mayor Mendenhall stepping up with some leadership there to take some steps to pull back regulation where it makes sense to help allow people to contribute to solving the drought that we're seeing here in Utah. Mm-hmm. You know, I, this is a Pandora's box, and I don't know that we have time to get into it, but the other one is, you know, when we look at the debate that the nation's having right now about a woman's right to choose and abortion and wanting to lower abortion rates, I would love to lower abortion rates.
Yeah, we can do it by expanding access to health care.
Well, there you go, right? And influencing behavior, access to contraception, access to health care, access to education. Again, is that an example of good regulation, bad regulation?
Yeah,
right?
I certainly think so, yeah. 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 And I just want to jump back to the Salt Lake City thing again, because every time we talk about the drought, I do think this is important. I think it's good. It's also something that I think I was flagrantly violating when I ripped out my park strip twice at two different homes. But I do think that we have to be focused again on really where our water consumption is happening. And I'm just going to make a plug one more time that we ban golf courses in this state.
I'm going to just note, I don't have a park strip. I have the street, the sidewalk, and then my front yard.
There you go.
There you go. Self-regulation. You'd have it no other way, I'm sure.
That's right.
Yeah, but back to, a much more serious issue when we're thinking about, making decisions about your own body and thinking about the size of your family and really the often really complicated decisions that people face when they enter into a pregnancy that may not be going as planned, right? For all sorts of reasons, health reasons and otherwise, there are so many things that we could be doing that would be so much more humane and I think sound when we think about actually driving down our abortion rates, which are quite low in this state and actually have come down since the expansion of the ACA. So as more people had access to healthcare, contraception, we're seeing those rates come down. We could take them down even further with, as you're suggesting, education, other kinds of interventions along the way. But what we're talking about is, in terms of, in some states, near complete bans, is really not, it's not sound, it's not good for people's health, it really strips people of their dignity and choice.
Well, yeah. I'm going to say, sorry.
Ben, no, go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say along this point, it was brought up about the federal government. Some folks want to expand and codify Roe v. Wade, et cetera, Casey, at the federal level. Some want to pare it back at the federal level. I'm from the perspective of keep the federal government out of it, and we're going to see how the different states shake out. And these laboratories of democracy will respond in different ways to their constituency.
Yeah.
Well, I'll say, so I keep fumbling and calling you Representative Dougal. It's because I've known you since you were in the state legislature.
That's
I was
right.
in the state Senate. And one thing I can say about you, and one of the things that frustrates me about politicians generally is we love the regulations that align with my worldview, and we hate the regulations that don't align with my worldview. I've seen State Auditor Dougal make Republicans mad, make
you
Democrats
can just call me
mad.
Frugal.
Frugal Dougal. I've seen the one thing I will say about you is you are consistent in your philosophy, and sometimes that makes your own party mad. Sometimes it makes Democrats mad, but I can respect, not always agree, but respect the integrity you have and fidelity to a coherent philosophy about government and regulation.
It's easy to be hypocritical, so it's really hard to maintain that consistency because too often you see the us versus them and things flip, and all of a sudden you take a different perspective. You see at the federal level. Deficits matter. Deficits
right.
don't matter. Deficits matter.
Both parties.
Both parties.
Deficits only matter to the party that's in the minority.
Yeah, or to me, it's always a problem.
Yeah. And I've seen that. So little update on an interesting local story. This is the Joel Ferry, current candidate for the Utah – current state legislator – former state legislator, right?
Former state legislator.
Sorry,
that's right.
Come on, let's get this.
So he resigned. He was confirmed as the Utah State Agricultural Commissioner for Governor Cox. And upon his confirmation, resigned from the state legislature. He is still a candidate. And if he wins, and the presumption is he will win because it's a Republican-heavy district, that upon winning, he will once again resign from the state legislature and the delegates would appoint a new person. So help us understand the law, the policy, what's going on here.
Well, I would love for somebody to explain this to me because my understanding is that what Democrats were asking is that his name should have been removed from the ballot as this process was. He was in kind of an acting role for quite a while in time that his name could have been taken off the ballot. It was not. So now it is there. And exactly as you're suggesting, it sets up this dynamic where if a person wins and for whatever reason they take another job, hopefully no one dies, but that does happen as well, then the party would be able to replace that person. But what Democrats, and I think kind of anyone looking at this with common sense would say, this is a person who was not intending to be in this role in the legislature. And so now we're in a dynamic where they're likely going to win. What happens? Do you know, John? What's going to happen?
If somebody steps down after they get elected, then the party, whichever party they're in, then goes through a process to nominate a candidate to go to the governor for appointment.
I don't know.
And stuff. And so that's kind of the process. And historically, there's been lots of situations where legislators get appointed by the governor to different positions. I'm unaware of any of those where the person actually was serving in the position until. So they will wait for the confirmation to step down. But they're not actually also serving in that new position until after they get through that confirmation. So this one is a little
unusual.
Funny in terms of the timing and odd in terms of the timing.
What's your
clearly the constitutional concern has been resolved. The serving on the cabinet as well as in the legislature, that's been
resolved when he resigned.
That was resolved when he resigned. But
I think the Utah Democrats have sued to remove him from the ballot. The courts will, I think, determine some of these questions of law and questions of constitution. What's troubling to me is the the perception, right? And it's from, I think, the governor, the lieutenant governor, to the party, to Representative Ferry, who I don't know him well, but seems to be a wonderful person and a good public servant. But, you know, this notion that elections don't matter, that we can skirt the laws, that you know, we can
run out
play
the clock
fast and loose with the Utah Constitution, run out the clock. I think just all in a time where our institutions are under attack, it undermines the credibility of the institutions in the eyes of the voters. And so whether it's legal or not, I do worry about doing something because we can.
So let me restate what I heard is really when so many people are questioning so many institutions, federal, state, et cetera, we need to do an extra job to try and have abide
uphold
by the rules, make sure it looks like it's a clean process and everything else like that to not have people call into question one way or another.
I think that's a burden we should all take to instill trust and faith in our institutions. In the final moments before we conclude, there are other races that are happening this November.
Okay.
So go to utahdebatecommission.org to see information about the debates that are coming
up.
A lot happening. Find out about your candidates and make sure to vote. So you've been listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Ben McAdams. I've been joined by Shireen Gourbani and John Dougal. And thank you to our producer, Anthony Scoma. Thank you for listening.